How can it be that New York State's gun control laws, some of the toughest in the country, failed to stop a race-crazed killer who unleashed his mania on innocent citizens in Buffalo, New York? Also, why is baby formula suddenly in short supply? And how about galloping inflation? Is the U.S. Treasury Secretary right that President Biden's Build Back Better spending splurge paid a negligible part in rising prices? And if we look abroad, should Americans be sanguine about NATO expansion to Sweden and Finland under the general rubric of serves Putin right? We'll talk about all this and more in today's episode of Independent Outlook. Hello, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you today from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California, right across the bay from San Francisco. As I shared on our broadcast 2 weeks ago, we recently lost our colleague David Thoreau, the founder of the Independent Institute and of this broadcast. He passed away suddenly and unexpectedly. David was remarkable, a serial entrepreneur, champion of liberty and law, writer and publisher of over 140 books, and of the influential quarterly, The Independent Review. We miss him. So, for that reason, let's get started. And I want to welcome, as usual, one of David's longtime colleagues, Dr. Williamson Evers, the director of our Center on Educational Excellence. Hello, Bill. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Glad for the chance to talk with you about the issues of the day from your unique vantage point. You are full of insights. We're going to try and mine some of those during today's discussion. I'm also glad that we're joined in our program today by many of our friends from around the country and some from around the world who are joining us via our YouTube page, our Facebook page, Vimeo, Twitter, and especially our friends on thinkspot.com. Welcome to all of you. So, Bill, we're looking at a number of interesting things this week. First of all, the stunning news that this crazy guy from New York State drove all the way from Binghamton area up to Buffalo to shoot a bunch of innocent civilians in a supermarket in a largely African-American neighborhood because he was a crazed racist. It's hard to believe that 10 people would be dead in a supermarket in just moments. So the question arises, what was he thinking, and then what can be done about it? I'm sure you've thought about this horrible incident, Bill.
I have, and it's great to be back. I missed the program 2 weeks ago because I had COVID-19, and I'm quite recovered, so I'm delighted to be back.
We're glad you recovered so quickly, Bill.
Thank you. So it's interesting, you know, there are all sorts of people with very far out views out there in the world. We have a huge population, and there are crazy socialists and crazy conservatives and crazy libertarians and crazy liberals, and all these sorts of things are out there. Obviously, the vast majority of people don't have these problems, aren't going to go attack people violently, mm-hmm. kill people. But this man had, he was a nationalistic socialist. So mm-hmm. he believed in workers' control of productive industry, providing the the workers were white and
right, exactly.
pro-Aryan, mm-hmm. and that they had his views. He had a Malthusian view. In other words, he feared a population crisis was going to destroy society. He wanted, a Europe of rural farms, of lakes and forests.
Yeah, a weird utopianism.
Population.
Yeah.
Well, we're strangely enough, I mean, we can find in killers in Norway and New Zealand, some of these same ideas, and some of them actually, I mean, I hate to bring up Hitler because everybody kind of makes everything, oh, so-and-so is another Hitler, but Hitler had some of these same environmentalist mm-hmm. ideas and some of the same Malthusian pressures that he saw in Germany, and he wanted to relieve that by seizing territory in the East. Anyway, the point is he had these views. Now, the liberals and the liberal politicians, the liberal news media are saying, oh, this is caused somehow by Tucker Carlson or conservative politicians mm-hmm. or something like this. This man explicitly said he hated conservatives.
Yeah, he said conservatism is dead. Thank God, he wrote in the screed he published beforehand.
He hated conservatives. He hated libertarians. He hated the free market. He hated free trade.
Yeah, he hated all those.
And, you know, he was a nationalistic socialist. Now, again, you can have that view, which is a sort of dumb and indeed maybe evil view, but it doesn't mean you're going to be violent. You could have that view and just have that wrongheaded view.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we have it. Now, New York has some of the strictest gun control laws in the country. It has these red flag laws that are supposed to, you know, indicate that so-and-so isn't safe to have a gun.
Mm-hmm.
But the man was a clever person, and he figured out how to evade the, so even though he had made explicit statements that might have meant he wouldn't get a gun, he
right.
said, oh, I was just joking.
Right, right.
And then, so that didn't trigger them. And, you know, there's concealed carry laws are extremely strong there.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a case of, and of course the president has, you know, said, oh, well, this is the cause of racism. I mean, he was a racist. There's
Absolutely.
No doubt about that.
His racism
very,
drove him.
Very anti-Jewish.
Right.
He
mm-hmm.
hated Fox News, which liberals claim caused this somehow, because he viewed Fox News as, you know, Jewish controlled. He was an anti-Semite.
He is
this anti-Semite, yes. And anyway, the liberals really are mind this for tendentious reasons. And I think it's more like this is a crazy person and, you know, it would be better to have concealed carry so people could protect themselves.
Right. That's the trouble. I mean, you know, I was looking at some of the details, especially in the light of the fact that President Biden made, you know, his appearance in Buffalo. And rightly so, to comfort those who were mourning.
Right. I think that was fine.
Yeah,
I actually appreciate it. The rest of it was not so fine.
Yeah, some of it was pretty inflammatory, really. I mean,
yeah.
And then, of course, the governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, has now announced earlier today a whole host of newly intended gun regulations in New York that will be even more specific than they were before.
Right.
And the strange thing is, I was reading up in some of these details. It seems that the rifle that he used was called a Bushmaster XM15ES, and which was not a banned assault weapon at the time that he purchased it, but he modified it. And, you know, there are details here that I don't need to get
into. The man clearly researched what he wanted to do.
Yeah. But I mean, the trouble is that in order for the law to solve this problem by somehow being sufficiently precise about what is and what isn't permitted, the law would have to be voluminous,
right?
And then have all sorts of unintended consequences. One analyst that I read commented that the problem is that it's irrational legislators who ban guns based on functionally unimportant features, and then.
Right.
There's all sorts
like
of
like the cosmetic features that it
right.
looks kind of like a
right.
AK-47 or something.
Right.
Like
and
that.
And of course, one response to that would be, well, if only then we kind of figured out all the different ways that bad people are going to get around this, and then we outlaw those too. you know, it becomes
it's more to me the fact that they fasten on the cosmetic things. A, it shows it's a very political and symbolic
right.
thing. And B, it shows they just don't know anything about guns and gun culture. So
right.
this is not the way to handle this. I want to mention personally, I've been kind of upset by this incident because when I try to put on Facebook analytical articles about the beliefs of this
yes.
shooter, Facebook says you're violating our community standards because in
really?
Order for an article even from a highly mainstream newspaper to discuss this man's beliefs, it brings up his beliefs about Jews controlling everything and all this stuff. And that triggers their algorithms, and therefore you can't post it.
You're merely describing his beliefs.
Right. But, of course, they're quoting from them.
Right.
And so it's a very strange phenomenon. I don't like it because, you know, I'm a policy intellectual. I like to be able to post things on social media that explain what's going on and what is motivating.
I mean, for example,
like
if you post something that says, look how horrible this guy is, and then you quote him, then it's going to be...
That's right. It blocks it. Right.
That's unbelievable. Well,
so it's just an interesting tale of our time.
It is indeed.
I think
I was struck by this analysis that Glenn Greenwald published yesterday, right. I think. His title was The Demented and Selective Game of Instantly Blaming Political Opponents for Mass Shootings. That was his title.
Right.
And boy, it's a long piece, and I'm not going to read it to you, thankfully. But I did learn quite a lot from it, which I kind of knew, but I kind of forgot. So, you know, he reviews all these politically motivated mass shooters, for example.
Particularly the one that wounded Steve Scalise.
Yeah, exactly. That guy was James T. Hodgkinson, apparently a devotee of Rachel Maddow, who had campaigned for Bernie Sanders. And he hunted down the Republican congressman and, you know, sniped at him and shot Steve Scalise. It would have been stupid to say that because he was an avid follower of Rachel Maddow, who described the Republicans as, you know, pretty dangerous and horrible people, that somehow she was responsible. She wasn't.
Right.
And then there's the case of all sorts of cases of self-described black nationalists who claimed that their shootings were to overcome white dominance and that they were against the police and so forth, including last month, you know, the guy Frank James in New York City, he said he was anti-police and so forth.
Right. Right.
There's all sorts of ideologists who are fomenting black nationalist and anti-police ideologies. That doesn't mean those people are guilty of Frank James's crimes.
That's right. And you can have a viewpoint that's very skeptical of police actions, maybe of police training, of police rules of engagement, wanting to have greater accountability of the police. That doesn't mean that when some fly-off-the-handle person shoots a policeman and maybe spouts some of that same rhetoric,
right,
that you are responsible. And the same, you can be, you know, black nationalism has its problems as an ideology, but that doesn't mean that it's responsible for every person that espouses those views and does something wrong.
I mean, the thing is, if we took it as a principle that if some horrible mass shooter has somehow ideas that happened in some respects to correspond to some political ideology, if we have to abandon every political ideology who's glommed onto by a crazy nut, we're going to have to eliminate all political points of view.
Not to speak of religions, right?
Not to speak of religions, exactly.
So
overkill.
Glenn Greenwald is a left of center guy, but he's very courageous and he's very thorough thinker in terms of thinking out the implications of things. So I think we should be grateful for him.
Yeah, he said, here's a quote I took note of. He said, Greenwald said, it is virtually impossible to find any ideology on any part of the political spectrum that has not spawned senseless violence and mass murder by its adherents. Sad to
say.
I
don't know about spawn, but I mean, had somebody who...
Yeah, happened to agree.
I've got a little catch in my throat. I'm going to put a throat lozenge in. It's going to make me not be as clear a speaker, but otherwise
it's worth it.
I'm sure. Time.
I'm sure that's fine. And of course, part of the reason that this particular interpretation has gained traction is that the killer in his published screed, part of which was plagiarized from the New Zealand mosque killer of a couple of years back, he mentioned his, you know, idea of white supremacy and his concern that white people are being replaced, he said. Okay, so that word replace has become kind of a trigger word. It happens to correspond with the word that some conservative, or are they right-wing? I don't know. Commentators have used, but it's...
No. The interesting thing here is this theory was originally put forward by Edward A. Ross, who was a he was at various schools, Nebraska, Stanford. And he was a sociologist. He was a pioneer. So this is the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. He was one of the founders of the discipline of sociology in the United States. He was an exponent of social control, how formal and informal institutions are the most important function in the United States is, or in any society, is social control. He was a critic of laissez-faire and capitalism. And most famously, he argued, again, this is at the early part of the 20th century, that Japanese coming to the United States on ships, they should be shooting the ships out of the sea.
Wow.
And so he was fired from Stanford for this. And his firing was the beginning of the American Association of University Professors.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
And so it's even more interesting. So I was a student at Stanford in the 1960s. And there was a English professor there named Bruce Franklin, who was a follower of Stalin and Mao. And so he got fired for an incident on campus. But he used to hold up this racist socialist of an early era as a socialist martyr that he was in the but anyway, it has its origins in a racialistic socialist, the Great Replacement Theory. He wrote an article in 1901. And I credit, I mean, that this whole milieu produced this is not unknown, but I think specifically pointing to this article, we should credit Phil Magnus of the American Institute for Economic Research.
Who is also a research fellow with us, for which we are very grateful.
Yes.
But Greenwald points out that while Carlson has used that term on occasion, he uses it in a much different way, not saying that one race is going to replace the other, but that somehow all American citizens of all races are threatened by unlimited immigration.
Right.
Which is very different from what this crazy guy, he said that people of the wrong race are themselves, whether they're citizens or not, they're a threat and have to be eliminated.
Right.
It's
a different viewpoint, but some of the language, rhetoric being used overlaps. So.
Yeah. I mean, it may be a lesson that you've got to watch how rhetoric that you use yourself can be misused. But at the same time, it doesn't make any sense to somehow attribute it to somebody who actually never made the same argument that this race-crazed guy has made. I'm struck.
We're not here saying that Tucker Carlson is perfect.
I disagree with him a lot.
He's saddled with something sometimes that he doesn't deserve to be saddled with.
Yeah, and you know,
maybe we could.
It was just to finish the thought, and it's important to note that because all sorts of people across the various ideological spectra have viewpoints that are controversial, sometimes strong and vehement, and if we say that anybody who somehow agrees with that does something terrible, that the point of view is somehow invalid, everybody's going to be invalidated. So I'm not standing up for Tucker Carlson per se. I'm standing up for the freedom to express views that are nonviolent and not be held accountable for these nutcases.
Exactly.
So what you said a minute ago, Bill, about Facebook, coming back to that.
Yeah,
I was stunned that what you just said, I hadn't heard this, and it rings this weird bell about the desire of the Biden administration to create this disinformation governance board, which would somehow survey all sorts of online stuff and prevent the growth of ideas, which could somehow lead to some bad outcomes. And I guess Facebook is totally on board with that themselves, because they think merely describing bad ideas is somehow to advocate them?
Well, they have this algorithm that picks up words and phrases. And, you know, they're in a kind of a hard problem. They have all these millions and millions of things that get posted.
Right.
And if you put some kind of law in there that says you can't post an anti-Semitic thing, then it's going to pick this up and block the same thing I'm complaining about. And you know, if they have their own review mechanism, editing, they can't possibly have enough people. So they have to use some kind of algorithm. The real question is, how can they modify the algorithm to somehow deal with cases like this? And B, if you respond, I protest, how fast do they get back to you?
Right. Well, when they announced this governance, the disinformation governance board, unfortunately, the announcer on behalf of Secretary Mayorkas did talk about misinformation around such things as elections and other matters, and especially to, I guess, informationally vulnerable communities or something like that was the terminology. They appointed this woman, Nina Yankovic, to be the head of it. And of course, the news just broke that now the Biden administration is rethinking this, that she tendered her letter of resignation yesterday, and they told her to hold it while they finally decide whether they are or are not going to disband this disinformation governance board. And then the Washington Post, of course, came out today with this remarkable article defending the disinformation governance board and defending Nina Jankowicz. Here's the headline from the Washington Post, Bill. How the Biden administration let right-wing attacks derail its disinformation efforts. And it's a remarkable story that almost turns the whole thing on its head.
Yeah.
And they say that the fact that people complained about Ms. Yankovic was an illustration of misinformation. And
I don't think so. The things that she promoted that were clearly wrong made her, talk about stepping on their own story or their own idea and sort of being host on their own petard here. They practically couldn't have had the story develop in a more
I know exactly.
But we're naturally not happy with a government information control mechanism, and you know, it's up to private people to decide what's right, what's wrong, what's
let people figure it out. I mean,
and let people refute other people, you know, say.
Well, in fairness to the Washington Post, who was trying to defend Ms. Jankowicz, they pointed out that as people began to raise objections to her, which were in fact factual and objective points, after that, then some unstable nutcases, you know, this is sounding familiar now, some unstable nutcases got worked up about it and started saying harsh and violent sounding things on the internet. So the Washington Post therefore concludes that somehow if people hadn't objected to her appointment and her previous statements, then the nutcases wouldn't have been empowered. And again, it's the whole principle. If we want government...
It's a heckler's veto.
It's a heckler's, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, but the government, all-powerful, looming to step in on behalf of the principle that hecklers deserve a veto to close down anything. It's very troubling. And I'm glad that the Biden administration is rethinking this.
Interestingly, Alex Berenson, who used to be a science reporter for the New York Times and did a lot of skeptical coverage of the COVID-19 policies, is suing Twitter to try to find out how much the federal government was involved with setting policy in social media.
Oh, very.
I don't think we really have time to get into this, but it'll be interesting what discovery in this legal case finds.
Just to be clear, regarding Nina Jankovic, she was the one who was or is going to head this disinformation management board. She herself had previously publicly and vociferously discredited the claim that the Hunter Biden laptop was really Hunter's, which turned out to be true, and even the New York Times and Washington Post acknowledged it. And she's the one also who had publicly offered her support for the notion that Christopher Steele was accurate when he created that nutty dossier that was later discredited as false. So when people objected to her appointment, it was because she had seized upon these pieces of misinformation promoted them herself, and the thought that she would have the power of the state behind her own very quixotic decisions about what is and what isn't true was, in fact, objectively disturbing.
I mean, you know, you could say, well, the Hunter Biden story came through Giuliani. He was having some shaky problems with some stories at that time. Or you could say, you know, a lot of government agencies found the Steele dossier somewhat plausible. But the fact that she really didn't have much of a critical eye or a skeptical eye is a very bad sign for somebody that would have a very, very powerful position.
It's one thing to have bad judgment when you're just a private citizen, but when you're the head of a very potentially powerful government agency, you know, watch out. And the solution to that is not, well, then only put perfect people in charge of government agencies.
There are no perfect.
The answer is don't have the government agency.
Exactly.
Speaking
of government agencies.
Yes, indeed.
We have a government agency or two government agencies, the FDA and the CDC, who are screwing up baby formula. So the root of the whole thing is sort of a twofold matter. So one is sort of a single incident. That is that somebody found some contaminant, some dangerous material in an Abbott Laboratories lab. So there are very few makers of baby formula in the United States. And part of this is because high import barriers are kind of a shield behind which monopolies form.
Right.
So there are very, very few makers of it. And by shutting down this Abbott Laboratories manufacturing plant, about 40% of the supply was suddenly cut off.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, they have very strict tariffs and they have strict safety and labeling laws. I mean, I could kind of defend them. Oh, you know, somebody gets a labeling law that's a label on the package of baby formula that's printed in Serbian. Come on. They can slap a new label on top of it if they're importing it. And Nestle, they have an emergency thing right now to allow importing, and Nestle is importing into the United States. Even the claim by the Food and Drug Administration that they're going to let Abbott reopen this lab. The latest story that I could find in the New York Post said, no, the Abbott people say they have not actually still been given the opening and that it might take 10 weeks to get back up to the, I mean, 10 weeks is a long
That's
time.
A long time when you got hungry babies.
Many mothers and babies need these formulas now.
Yeah.
The fact that we have these stringent import controls is the underlying serious problem.
Not only that, but as I understand, one of the reasons for the dominant market position of Abbott is that they are one of the primary, if not the primary, contractor with the Women, Infants, and Children program, which means that their monopoly position is reinforced both by protection from foreign competition with tariffs. And by the
welfare
contract.
And welfare contracts, yes.
Yeah,
welfare
which favor contracts. That favor their position. And so the government has created a favored monopoly position where the market is dependent largely on one supplier. When one supplier has a problem, then everything just multiplies.
Now, obviously, another thing that's being pointed to is that a certain amount of this infant formula is in the stocks of FEMA, so the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and a fair amount of it's in the hands of federal border people. So if you have babies coming in or mothers that are giving birth on the border or something, and maybe they can't take mother's milk, then they need formula. And obviously, if there's a disaster of some sort and FEMA is helping out, they need
stockpiling it was reasonable.
Yes. On the other hand, if you unload the stockpile, it doesn't, it might help temporarily, just like a strategic petroleum reserve might have a tiny effect. But really, the problem is bigger than these stockpiles. So I think the people that are bringing these up are people who are trying to really make a point about immigration policy more right. than they're trying to make a point about baby formula.
Yeah, I mean, and you can argue
like everybody else, they're using, they're taking, right. grabbing for any
right.
thing.
No. I mean, I'm up, you know, for a discussion about border policy and so forth, but I think that the baby formula dimension of the border argument is a little bit of a distraction from, as you point out, the major issues.
The real problem is they shut down this thing, this manufacturing plant. They actually never found any poisonous stuff in the baby formula. And so they should have reopened it right away instead of months. So the first indication that there conceivably could be a problem was like in September. Mm-hmm. In February, they more or less determined that they needed to really look into it, so they shut it down. Okay, they found out pretty quickly there was no problem. It's now mid-May. Come on, why isn't it open at the end of February or beginning of March or something like that? And why back then didn't they unleash imports? And why didn't some people in Congress or the administrative agencies say, maybe we shouldn't have these import restrictions?
Right.
So anyway.
You know what's fascinating? There's a piece that our colleague, our research fellow, Ray March, has just published in Fortune, which really analyzes this very well. It's on our website, independent.org. Here's what it looks like by Raymond March and Glenn Furton. The FDA could easily solve the baby formula shortage by allowing more imports from Europe, he notes. And in the article, he points out that the issue is, on one level at least, labeling requirements, as right. you mentioned before. But he points out that the formulas from European manufacturers meet FDA's nutritional impurity standards, but don't meet their labeling standards. So in a situation like this, what really matters is the purity, not the label. So he says, why not let there be more imports? And of course, gradually, I think that's what's happening, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it's an emergency thing. It's yeah. like, mm-hmm. it's like, I just saw a thing where the American Medical Association says, well, we let nurse practitioners do things during COVID, and that was an emergency. But now we're going to stop nurse practitioners from doing right. things that they did perfectly well during COVID-19, but we want our doctor's monopoly back. So right. the same with the infant formula. This is an infant formula shortage. We're going to let the regulations lapse a little bit, but we'll slap them back on as soon as we can.
Why don't we learn from these crises that the crises are either caused by or exacerbated by excessive government involvement in whatever, you know, the market for it is, whether it's healthcare or in this case, baby formula. Why don't we learn that it was a bad idea for government contracts to be so favorably concentrated and a bad idea to have so many tariffs to prevent imports? We should learn from those things long term and let people freely produce, buy and sell. Then we're going to have way few crisis shortages.
I think you're absolutely right, Graham. I think, you know, I point to two things. One is not enough of the population is really economically literate. It's hard. It's not a natural, easy thing to understand things no. like mm-hmm. supply and demand and opportunity cost and all various analytic things. And it's not that hard, but it's not just on its face easy to understand. And secondly,
one of our friends online from our Facebook page, Katrina, writes, more competition in the USA. Common sense, she says. Okay, Katrina, I think you're on the right track.
I agree. And the second thing is that the special interests are concentrated, and the people who could benefit from competition and lowering the stranglehold of the special interests are dispersed and gain only a little bit of money from it, whereas the special interests are reaping monopoly profits from hanging on to their positions. So we got, and this is why we have programs like this, and all the books and articles that come from
exactly.
Independent Institute and other good think tanks to try to push back against this.
Exactly. And by the way, just a reminder to everybody who's with us, we do have our website, independent.org, which is full of evidence-based analyses of these and other issues. You ought to take advantage of it. Among those issues was one I thought of day before yesterday when I filled up my gas tank. I've never spent so much money in my life to fill up my gas tank. And I think that's probably true of millions of Americans now. And it's
this guy I know, Mark Tucker, was in Death Valley and he posted a picture. Admittedly, Death Valley is, you know, it's an out of the way place.
It's remote.
The gas prices were all over $8.
Oh my goodness. That's worse than the $6.99 here or whatever. You know,
unleaded, regular diesel. They were.
Right. And of course, unfortunately.
Premium diesel, all over $8.
Unfortunately, so not just gasoline, also food and all sorts of other things are on the way up, and everyone is realizing something is wrong. The other day,
in the Bay Area, they're over $6.
Yeah, exactly.
A gallon.
Yeah.
Well, we have a lot of strange things that are going on here. One is that the Biden people are saying, and Biden himself is saying, well, the solution to this is more gigantic government programs and big spending. So this is obviously not the solution. This is things like the American Rescue Plan and all the spending that was connected and all the COVID relief, some of which was certainly under Trump. A lot of it has been brought in and escalated under President Biden. So all this money, this printing press money, and this monetization of the debt that leads to this printing press money, this amount of money chasing after the goods that are produced in the society leads the prices to go up.
Right.
And so they have to stop that, and then they have to provide some regulatory relief and tax relief, and that will make things a little easier on us. But there's probably going to be a correction. And I don't know, the stock market is looking pretty ugly these days. And maybe we're seeing some of the correction right now.
It may well be. It was a little disturbing to have the U.S. Treasury Secretary say a couple of days ago that while she acknowledged that the spending programs had fed inflationary pressures, it really wasn't the major point. And she talked about the war in Ukraine and supply chain issues as a result of the pandemic and so forth. Both those things no doubt had their impact. But the underlying problem, I think, is the one you described. There's no way the prices won't go up.
Okay, but there's several things to this. So, okay, Ukraine war. Well, the United States is spending a lot of money. I mean, they're having... It's so much money. So generally, I think of the Heritage Foundation, where I know many, many people, as certainly not reluctant to spend money on military activities. And they are raising a very strong cautionary flag about the amount of money that's being poured into this Ukraine conflict. It's a lot of money, as Senator Rand Paul said, and they don't... They don't have a auditor. They don't have a person that is, checking to see how the money is spent. We know from the Inspector General's reports from Afghanistan how carelessly that money was spent. And we have to, if you're going to spend this kind of money, at least you should keep an eye on it. And maybe at least somebody will be embarrassed by some of the things that go on. So this is part of the cost. U.S., obviously, along with Russia, along with Europe, contributed to this losers on every side war that we're having in Ukraine. Obviously, the Ukrainians are losing the most, but, Poland is going to be saddled with all these refugee costs. Russia is losing lots of people. Russia is a pariah state. It looks like Sweden and Finland are going to join NATO. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not everybody is coming out a loser, and a lot of Ukraine is being destroyed and people killed there. So anyway, that's expensive, and we're having food taken off the market because of the huge grain output of Ukraine.
Which has been cut off now.
That's right. The seaports are cut off and people can't plant and harvest and so forth. Planting now, but harvesting eventually. And yes, supply chain has problems. There was, you know, things were confused during COVID, but the fact that the U.S. is, I mean, the U.S. had tariffs and other blocks on steel from Ukraine at the same time we're pouring foreign aid into Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So we have these weird contradictory policies. So anyway, if they would unblock a lot of the regulations involved with trade, costs would go down. They could block the job licensing things that contribute to poverty in the United States and lack of upward mobility, and that a lot of things could be done that would make the economy work more smoothly. But we're probably going to have some kind of contraction, some kind of correction because of this huge money supply expansion. And let's just hope that some things are eased so that it isn't too catastrophic.
Yeah, I'll say. And I think that it doesn't help, though, for, you know, key leaders like the Treasury Secretary to kind of downplay and backpedal what, in fact, is the largest drivers behind the problem of inflation, namely the remarkable expenditures coming from the federal government, financed through deficit borrowing and creation of money, driving demand and leading to higher prices. These are factors that you just can't get away from. And even if you tried to get away from them by legal or governmental action, such as, oh, let's make a law so that prices can't go up.
good
luck with that.
No, they're trembling some kind of energy security law in Congress. So here are the numbers.
Okay.
Beginning of the COVID, the government created $3 trillion of new bank reserves. This is the monetization of the debt, and sent checks to people and businesses. Then they borrowed another $2 trillion. If I said it was $3 trillion in the beginning, and then they borrowed another $2 trillion, and they also sent that out. So the federal debt rose almost 30%. So, you know,
30% in a short span.
This is a policy that has consequences.
Right.
So another thing that they could do in terms of the supply side is the ports could run more free. They could like operate 24 hours a day. They could have automation. The unions who are in collaboration with the Democrats, the Longshoremen's Union, block automation. That would let the ports run much more smoothly. So there's a lot of policy things that could be done. Obviously, the gasoline supplies and petroleum, natural gas supplies are affected by pipelines. You can't have, you know, crude energy if you can't get it to someplace it can be refined. It's not do any good. So if we're blocking pipelines, and again, the Biden people are doing that as a matter of policy, so they shouldn't really be surprised that gasoline prices at the pump are
high. You mentioned blocking pipelines. You're referring to the Keystone pipeline, which would have brought a huge torrent of petroleum from Canada down into U.S. refineries. Not going to happen. And largely for environmentalist concerns, I believe, in the Biden administration. These things have consequences, and I suppose we should probably just go back to one of your points a moment ago, that we should probably give a shout out to some of our friends over at the Heritage Foundation, with whom we don't always agree, but it's kind of heartening to see them seeing the downside of military action and military spending. They haven't always seen the downside of it.
I think one of the benefits of the Trump years is that things that were kind of given automatically a pass and things that he labeled endless wars are getting fresh scrutiny. And I think that, that's not to be scoffed at. I think just getting back to this Ukraine war matter that we were introducing with regard to inflation, there's an increasing shift that makes so there's U.S. aims and there's also Russian and Ukrainian aims, and interspersed in there are European aims. But anyway, so Ukraine is starting to think they're doing so well that they can win. And I mean, win in a big way, maybe drive the Russians out of Crimea.
That would be a big achievement. No,
they're starting to talk that way. And the problem is not so much that they're going to be able to do that. The problem is that given the people, so Ukraine is an imperfect democratic country, but it is democratic in many respects, and public opinion has its effect, as it even does in autocratic countries. And so the problem is that any Ukrainian leader who settles for things like we agree to be a neutral country like Austria was after in the early part of the Cold War, and we, you know, maybe go back to the boundaries before this invasion, at least as a temporary measure, and so forth, they would be denounced as a traitor now.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, the Russians have a kind of a related dynamic. Since they're not doing very well militarily, they are afraid of settling because that would be perceived as a defeat.
Yep.
And Putin has had a lot of problems. His economy has not been doing well. And, you know, the corruption situation has not really improved. And, you know, you could view the whole thing as kind of a mafia state. So they don't want to improve it, but the perception of corruption situation has not been improved. So to have a military defeat, he went into this war in part because as a military leader, he could maybe sustain this program he has of being president for life of Russia. And he got a big boost when Crimea was taken over, and he was hoping for another big boost. But anyway, if he's perceived as being defeated, it will undermine his legitimacy, his popularity, and so forth. So the U.S. is also kind of shifting in its view in a related and connected way. So, and Britain is, and so forth, but I'll just cover the U.S. So the U.S., you know, originally thought, well, maybe we can slow this down a little. Maybe the Russian quick takeover, instead of being 1 week, will be 2 weeks or maybe a month or something like that. But now the U.S. is also thinking, well, if we prolong this, we can engage in the strategic attrition, the strategic running down of Russia. We can get the Russians to spend it all, to deplete all their military supplies, blow up all their tanks. Everything will be, that there'll be a less powerful, influential presence.
Joe Biden said he wants to weaken Russia.
Well, and also they're talking, yes, that's right. And they're talking about, is there some way we could get Putin out of there? Okay. So I actually heard a commentator recently saying, well, the U.S. isn't talking about regime change. Actually, powerful people are letting, you know, having bloopers or gaffes or something where they do say they want Putin out. So this is a pretty maximalist goal that the United States is starting to engage in.
And now, to be clear, Bill, quick interruption. To be clear, there's nothing wrong with wanting Putin to be out. As a private citizen, many of us may well want that. But we're talking about people.
Including me.
Okay. Yeah, and
but
me
I'm
too.
Not president of the United States or vice president of the United States or secretary of defense or secretary of state.
Right, exactly.
The thing is, anyway, and this is also happening in other Western countries. So it's creating a very, very bad dynamic to getting toward peace.
Right.
And obviously the whole thing of bringing in Sweden and Finland into NATO adds an additional dimension to this. So they're actually a liability for NATO.
Right.
I mean, it might look good from the Swedes and the Finns' point of view.
It's great for them, I guess.
But it's they don't really add. I mean, they have fairly decent armies, but they're small. And the you know, Finland has a huge border with Russia and fought Russia twice in the 1940s.
And Putin has moved tactical. He's moved tactical nuclear weapons up close to the Finnish border now, apparently.
Right. When I was a kid, I read a joke book from the 1940s, and it said, "What is the Soviet-Finnish War? A fight to the Finnish." It said.
Anyway, oh boy,
little kid joke. Anyway, so it wasn't a fight to the Finnish. The Finnish fought them to a standstill.
They did.
And worked out a modus vivendi. But the thing is, not only do you start adding obligations, then pretty soon Poland has said, well, we want an American army based in Poland.
Right.
Or Estonia says, we want to be able to do X, Y, and Z with the Russian speakers in our area, and please protect us by putting missiles in there. Whatever, you start multiplying this, it's also expensive. I mean, the greater the geographical area and boundary line that you have to defend, the more the American taxpayer is going to be hit with this. Mm-hmm. So it's not that Russia isn't threatening to invade Finland or Sweden right now. This is just these countries taking advantage of a situation.
Right. They perceive weakness.
Openness of, yeah. And they perceive an opportunity that it's hard for the NATO countries to deny them entry, given what's happened to Ukraine. Now, the only person that's balking is Turkey, and only semi-balking. And the reason they're balking is because Kurdish political activists live in Sweden.
Right, okay? Members of Stockholm, the Kurdish People's Party.
Right, right. So, you know, not my favorite party. But anyway, they Swedes have had a pretty open... You can think of Americans who fled the draft to go to live in Sweden and all sorts of different things over the years. So anyway, that they may, Turkey and Sweden may be able to work that out. I don't know. But the point is that things that really don't warrant, I mean, NATO itself is a problematic thing, as Senator Robert Taft Sr. pointed out long ago.
Long ago.
But the more intricate you make it, the more opportunities for something to go wrong.
I suspect that President Erdogan of Turkey also sees an interesting opportunity for himself, not merely to get some pressure against his internal adversaries in the Kurdish People's Party, but also if he is playing the role of the host of the peace talks,
right,
and he's the one who's standing in the way of NATO membership for Finland and Sweden, the Russians may take his role more seriously. It may give him a stronger position to broker a peace. And you know, if he manages to broker a peace, I would say if we can fend off a drastic war and stop the bombardment and bring peace to the people of Ukraine and Russia, the whole world would be better off.
Right. So he says himself as sort of Theodore Roosevelt during the Russo-Japanese War of 1905. But, or four, 1904, whatever it was, right, in that period. Anyway, the point is, Erdogan also has serious domestic problems. He's got inflation running at an extremely rapid pace. He's, you know, he's just in election trouble. And he's another country that's a kind of quasi-democracy. And they do have elections there, and they take the elections seriously. So if he could distract this by being a major figure on the world stage, he may maybe domestically benefited by that.
Well, you know, I would say that if he does get domestically benefited, that may not be great for the Turks, but it might be worthwhile to have an actual brokered peace.
And Macron was trying to do some of that at various points, too. There could be other... We don't know who might lead to something here, but there are ongoing negotiations, but they are described in the New York Times as stalled and going nowhere and so forth. So they're centering on things like prisoner exchange and humanitarian aid. They can't seem to get... I explained the dynamic of Ukraine thinking it's winning, so why should they go to outsettle, and Russia fearing a perception of defeat. So why should they go anywhere? And America hoping to bleed Russia dry. So why should they encourage peace? I just think for the sake of the people, you know, that are dying, and the general benefits of peace and the restoration of prosperity in the world, this is disrupting the economy of the world.
It's bad.
Let's get to peace.
It's bad for everyone, exactly. Let's come back home for a last couple minutes here at the end of our program, Bill. Here's a couple of interesting legal news points. One here in California is that a Superior Court judge in Los Angeles ruled against California's landmark law that had required women to be in a certain proportion on corporate boards. And the judge has ruled that that's a violation of California's constitutional equal protection clause. We're not surprised.
We're not surprised also because there had been a previous racial quota law that was thrown out on the same ground. So I think once that happened, it was clear that this was going to happen. I think it's a good thing. And our colleague, Mary Thoreau, wrote about it at the time, saying that this was a flawed thing. Another kind of legal thing that is happening is restrictions that the Biden administration is proposing to put on aid to charter schools. So charter schools are public schools, but they're independent of the local school boards in a large degree. They don't have to obey the huge rule books of public education. They get public money and they have to abide by health and safety and civil rights rules, but basically they're autonomous. And so they've been very good at helping low-income kids, minority kids. And the Biden people, many of the officials in which, you know, previously were kind of favorable to charter schools, but under the teachers union pressure, they turned against them. So now they say they have to prove that they don't have any negative fiscal impact on the regular public schools. Hey, I'm sorry, if the regular public schools are not doing a good job and the kids migrate into the charter schools and that somehow makes the, you know, purse strings tighter for the regular public schools, too bad. Go, you know, compete, do a better job. Maybe you'll get them back. Mm-hmm. And they're also saying, well, I have to prove that they have diversity in their faculty and on and on. So they're just loading them with bureaucratic things that will block charter schools. And, you know, I mean, Senator Dianne Feinstein, all sorts of interesting people that are the political strange bedfellows of trying to save the lives of children, give them educational opportunities, have written to the administration saying, don't do this. But it seems like they're on the path to doing it.
You were going to mention to me maybe one last thing about this case that Ted Cruz argued regarding the Federal Election Commission.
An absolutely fascinating case. So going back to the original law case, Buckley v. Vallejo, about campaign finance, we all remember that in the wake of various scandals in the past, Senator McCain and others loaded our campaign laws with various restrictions. So you had to report all sorts of things, which is onerous, but could be worse. But then there's also how much you can contribute and what ways you can contribute and who can contribute and so forth. So one of the things that the law has held all along is that you can't corrupt yourself. So if you campaign and you spend your own money, you're not unduly influencing yourself. You're not bribing yourself. Right. You're not casting a bad light on the election process. This is a supposed perception of corruption, right? Even if there is none. So you can't really do that to yourself. So you should be able to do self-financing. Now, one of the things that they put in was, okay, if you lend your campaign money, you can pay back some of that from donations, but you can't pay it all back. So it can only pay back to a certain extent. So let's say you own a small business or you're a legal professional or something like that, and you have some money and you loan to your campaign, which many people do, you can't get all your money back. And what this does, as is really much of the purpose, in fact, of campaign finance regulation, is it locks in the incumbents, it protects them from competition, it protects them from rivals. And one of the kind of rivals that you could have is a self-financing candidate. And that self-candidate, funding candidate, would like to be able to pay himself or herself back. Well, the court found that it was a denial of free speech. This is FEC versus Ted Cruz, the senator, and his campaign. And he deliberately, he's litigated 9 times in front of the Supreme Court. He's a very smart,
he's pretty good
legal
at it.
Mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so he thought this is ripe for a, you know, better decision. And it follows, the funny thing is, so there's all this discussion of precedent and stare decisis and so forth in connection with abortion right now. But the tendency of Supreme Court decisions is to chip away on free speech grounds on these regulations of campaign finance. And this goes back to the earliest days of considering it. Well, the funny thing is that the same people that are jumping up and down about precedent don't want to have precedent on this. They, in fact, want to throw out the free speech rights of people who run for office or people who donate to people running for office. So the Wall Street Journal said, well, isn't it funny to see how they reverse their view toward precedent when they don't like what the precedent.
And it was a 6-3 ruling, right?
Yeah, yeah. I also think that Clarence Thomas said, I think the correct thing is that, you know, what you want to do is interpret the Constitution correctly in light of what it says, in light of what it meant. And if it's been persistently interpreted wrongly in terms of what it says and what it meant, then you want to overturn it. And then people who shout precedent at that point are people who don't have a good argument.
Right. Brown versus Board of Education, for example. It overturned precedent. And that was probably welcome.
I think we can't deal with that at the end of our program.
No, indeed. we're going to have a lot of interesting Supreme Court rulings issued over the next month. And I anticipate we're going to be talking about them. Gun rights, obviously the abortion case. You know, we're all watching to see which ruling is going to be leaked next before it's officially released. Hopefully no more of them, but there's going to be a lot of news of that type. It should be quite interesting over the month ahead. And we will do our best to bring everybody our best analytical wits between the two of us, and a number of our colleagues will be joining us over programs ahead. So keep coming back to us here at the Independent Institute. Any final word of wisdom from you, Bill?
Yes, I noticed that the president has put us back into Somalia.
Oh,
and I think we probably can expect the same result as we had last time.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's depressing. Okay, thank you for that gloomy but realistic word, Bill. And thanks again to all of our friends who've joined us from long distances and short here for this episode of Independent Outlook. We do invite you to come back to our website, independent.org, for all the resources that we can offer you on these and other topics. We try our best to always have an eye for individual liberty and law, as well as for evidence when we bring you this material. And Bill Evers is a big part of that. So thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Graham.
And thanks,
everybody. And thank you to those listening in.
Absolutely. We'll see you next time on Independent Outlook. Bye, everybody.